Morning. Today's daf nida is Chav Zayin. We're in Chav Vav Amud Beis. We are somewhere in the middle of the Amud. We're going to start back a little bit. We're going to start this morning with the words Yosef Rav Yitzchak Bar Shmuel. Our topic of discussion is a shilya. We're talking about the afterbirth of a birth. The Gemara discusses it from a halachic context. There are a number of points to take into consideration. An afterbirth is not the birth. It's not a vlad, obviously. From a simple biological standpoint, it's the source of nutrition for the baby. But after the baby's born, so then the afterbirth comes out, and the afterbirth coming out marks the conclusion of the birth. Hence, it's called the afterbirth. The number of considerations in terms of halacha. Number one, what about Tumas Meis? So that was our Mishnah. So obviously, again, the afterbirth is not considered a vlad. It's not human remains. It's just considered organic material. But it's not considered mace, so it's not going to be matam in the house. The question, which the Mishnah dealt with, which we're going to come back to a little bit later this afternoon, morning. I lost my whole sense of day. Anyway, we're going to come back to it, and that is the question of, well, listen, if there's an afterbirth, so that means that there was a birth, right? And even if there's no evidence that there was a baby, but we have to assume that there was some baby that was there, even though we can't identify where the baby is right now. So that is a discussion which we're going to be having a lot today. That's going to be a good part of today's daf, more than half of today's daf, dedicated to that discussion. And what we also discuss is, let's say there's a lag, a significant interval between the birth and the afterbirth. Birth came out, and then the afterbirth came out, and it wasn't consecutive. It wasn't contiguous events. And under those circumstances, are we now going to be concerned with the fact that maybe this afterbirth was connected and related to another baby? And so that was another discussion, and that's the discussion that we're in the middle of having right now. So the question becomes, if a baby was born and then an afterbirth came out and it was not contiguous events, so let's say it's separated by a week, okay, just to throw out a number, it was separated by a week, so now there is a real concern, a real consideration that now this afterbirth is really connected to another baby. And even though we don't exactly know where the other baby is, but we have to connect it to another baby. Why is that important halachically? So Rashi, yesterday's daf, explained a number of things to take into consideration. Let's say the first baby that came out was male. So that means that her tumah is only going to be 733. And now the afterbirth comes out, let's say, a week later. And we don't know that it's connected to another... We're pretty sure it's not connected to this baby. So it's connected to another baby. That other baby could be a female. All right, so already... that's nafkamina number one, meaning her days of tumah tahara are not going to be 733. Now, it's also not going to be 1466 because we don't know what that second baby is. But at least to be machmir, and instead of her observing 7 days, she's now going to have to observe 14 days. So that's one point of consideration. Another where it gets more complicated, which we already dealt with a couple days ago, is in terms of when to start her yemei tumah and her yemei tahara. Because if we're now suggesting that the afterbirth is not connected to the original birth, so now that means that afterbirth is connected to another baby, and we don't know when that other baby comes, so now it's going to affect when she starts counting her Yemei Tumah and Yemei Tahara of the Leda. So there's a number of considerations over here on whether or not we can suggest that the afterbirth and this birth are either connected or not connected. This is the discussion we're having. We're going to start back just a little bit. We did this yesterday, but it's a good starting point. Yosef Rav Yitzchak Bar Shmuel Bar Marta Kameh Derav Kahana V'Yosef Kama Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav. So a number of Amarayim are now going and quoting Rav. And they said in the name of Rav, Kol Shoshiyam Em Rishonim Tolim Sashil Yibavad Mikan Ve'Ela Choshin Levlan Achir. So if there is less than 3 day interval between the birth and the afterbirth, so then we can say that they're connected. And this afterbirth represents the birth. However, if it's more than 3 days, so then they are no longer connected. And we have to now say that this afterbirth is reflecting another baby. Again, with the nafkaminas that I already spelled out. So Amarle Umi Amar Rav Hachi. So the Gemara says, now on this, we're confused. We're very confused because we have another statement of Rav. So the Gemara says another statement of Rav is that when it comes to the birth of twins, so there is no delay between one twin and another twin. They're going to come out one after another. And v'kachaya, meaning it's funny that Rav is saying this. We know just empirically that when twins come out, they come out one after another. But the point is as follows. If twins come out one after another, look, we have a shilya that's coming out, 3 days later, 4 days later, 5 days later. or even let's say 2 days later. So I don't have to go that far. We have a shilya coming out 2 days later. So we're saying that the shilya is we're asking the question whether it's attributable or not attributable to another baby. How could it possibly be attributable to another baby? Rav said elsewhere that if babies are coming out, meaning twins are coming out, they're coming out one after another. So ishtik, so he was quiet. He didn't know how to respond. So he said like this. Oh, I think I know the difference. I think I can explain the distinction. When is it possible that twins are going to come out and it's not consecutive and it's not going to be necessarily back to back, but there could be an interval between them? That's when it's nefel ben kayama. If one of the twins is a stillborn and the other twin is viable, so then Rav would be of the position that there could be a delay. If, however, they were both viable, so in that regard, so Rav says that they're it's possible. Kam benefel, kam ben kayama. So by a nefel, so there could be a delay. But if it's a ben kayama, so then we would presume that there is not going to be any delay between one and the other. So amale adamar l'shmaita de Rav beferish amar Rav. So he says, okay, you're saying that in order to explain Rav. I heard the following directly from Rav. Hachi. So let's say a woman gave birth to a nephil. Okay, so the first one was a non-viable baby. And then afterwards comes the shilya. So koshol shiyamim told me so shilya bevlad. Oh, here we go. So in other words, so now we're seeing Rav saying it beferish. And that is that if the shilya is following a nephil, if the afterbirth is following a stillborn. So under those circumstances, we're going to say they're connected, but only within a three-day gap. But if it's more than a three-day gap, so then we have to be concerned that, in fact, another baby came out. Yaldavacha kachi pila, shilya. If, let's say, she gave birth to a viable entity, and then afterwards shilya came out, and afterbirth came out, afilu mikan v'adasar yamim ein choshen v'lad achir. So there, we're not worried about another baby. Ah, why aren't we worried about another baby? Because once the first baby that came out was a viable baby, so then if there was another one, it would have come out immediately. The fact that it didn't come out means that there was none. There was no other one. And meaning to say now that the afterbirth that comes out 10 days later is going to be connected with this baby, not with any other baby.
How about the second one could be a nephil,
though, no? Yeah, it's funny. You literally read my mind. That's why I was... that was my thought process as I was reading the Gemara. And, okay, it's a good question, and I don't know. Okay, Shmuel v'tamidei d'Rav v'Rav Yehuda v'Yasvei. Okay, Shmuel together with the students of Rav, together with Rav Yehuda. Now, not to be confused, Rav Yehuda is also a student of Rav, but in other words, Rav Yehuda was prominent, and Rav Yehuda not only was a student of Rav, but remember Rav Yehuda's trajectory. He first learned by Rav. Unfortunately, Rav died, and then he moved and he went over to Shmuel. Often is the time where Shmuel wants to know what did Rav say, so he returned to Rav Yehuda, who was previously a Talmud of Rav. And so Rav Yehuda kind of said the bridge between Rav and Shmuel. Rav and Shmuel, you know, it sounds like from the Gemara, they interacted as well and they debated as well. But but Rav Yehuda was a Talmud to both of them, and so Shmuel now is speaking, and presumably this is after the demise of Rav. And Chalavazo Rav Yosef Bereid Rav Menashe Medvil La Paya Balavase. Now, so you have this group of Rabbanim, Shmuel, Rav Yehuda, and a number of other Amoraim, all students of Rav. They're walking, and Rav Yosef now walks at a brisker pace. And he laps him. He walks right in front of them. Right? The expression of the Gemara is la'apayu in front of them, bale v'ase. He's like walking really quickly. So the following was said. Now, I don't know who said it, and it's not going to be a flattering comment about Rav Yosef. And in general, you have to wonder whenever you see Gemaras like this, or occasionally we're going to see Gemaras like this, when you have non-flattering comments by one Amora about another Amora, so, you know, it's always a little bit. It's a little bit awkward. It's a little bit uncomfortable. Meaning we know, generally speaking, you're not allowed to taunt. You're not allowed to tease. You're not allowed to onas devarim. Certainly not allowed to speak lashon hara. And so what you have to do is you have to give a certain amount of context. I'm not going to give it its proper context, but I'm just, in other words, just think positively in terms of, even though these are negative comments, but they could be understood within a positive context. Anyway. So here comes a guy, in other words, they're talking about Rav Yosef, who, Ramina le begila dechitata, you ask him questions. Now, the Gemara over here is speaking b'derech mashal, it's an analogy. So it's stubbles of wheat, kernels of wheat. And in other words, basically, you throw a little chaff at him, Umir me matre, and that blows him away, meaning that he's not confident about any of his positions then, and you challenge him a little bit, and he backs off from his positions pretty quickly. Again, I know it's not a flattering comment they're saying about Rav Yosef. If we had a little more context, I bet it would come out sounding a lot better. And meanwhile, Shmuel says to him, do me a favor, he says to Rav Yosef, could you tell me a teaching of Rav as it relates to Shulya, as it relates to the afterbirth? If you want to connect the afterbirth to the birth has to be something which is a ben kayama. It has to be something which is doesn't have to be viable, but at least it has potential viability. Meaning to say it has to be in a formed state where such a creature could exist, but such a human could exist. But if it's already, if its deformity is so pronounced, right? Rashi gives examples of where its deformity is so pronounced. Rashi, Divra Maschel, Ela B'davishol Kayama, Shekayote B'miskayim, Imayom Haya Chadash of Kalo. Meaning if it was fully gestated, it would have survived. Examples that we gave earlier in this parak. It has one thigh, and the one thigh is not on the side of the is not on the side as it should be, but it's in the center. Or basically it's a torso with no extremities. Or it looks like an animal. Okay, all these deformities that we described earlier in the Masechta. So this statement to Rav is that when is the afterbirth and the birth connectable? When do I say that the afterbirth over here is connected to this particular birth? Only when the birth is not viable, but potentially viable. Meaning it's formed enough so such a fully gestated fetus could survive. Okay, so. Now, this is the first time Shmuel is hearing this halacha in the name of Rav. So Shmuel looks for corroboration. He had all these students of Rav around him, and he turned to all of them and he said, you heard that? And they said, yeah, sure, of course. That's what Rav said. We've heard him say that. And now Shmuel turns to Rav Yehuda, and he was upset with Rav Yehuda. Because Rav Yehuda, again, was a prominent student of Rav, and he went over to Shmuel, and generally speaking, Rav Yehuda reported and reviewed the teachings of Rav together with Shmuel. And this he never said over, even though Rav Yehuda clearly knew this halacha. But he never said it over to Shmuel, and Shmuel was upset. That Rav Yehuda never shared this particular halacha with him. Abay mine Rav Yosef ben Shalmi Rabbi Amapelsimus Orev Vishul Yamahu. Okay, more questions of connecting the birth and the afterbirth. So again, the significance halachically is that if we can connect them, that's great. If we can't connect them, so then we have to assume that the afterbirth is connected to another baby, even though we right now don't know the whereabouts of this other baby. What if what came out is something so deformed it looked like a bird, specifically a raven, and an afterbirth? What do we say then? Could we connect the two? So Amarle ain't told an elbadavashesh bemino shilya. No, you can't connect the two. Raven doesn't even have a placenta. So you can't connect it with something that's so deformed, and not only that, but its deformed shape doesn't even itself have an afterbirth. So Kishur Bamahu, what if they're actually connected? Meaning this deformed fetus that came out looking like a raven is actually connected to the afterbirth. Amarle Davashena Shalta. So he says, look, at this point in time, what you're describing is impossible. And so I'm not ready to answer impossible questions. Okay? In other words, I'm ready to deal with halachic matters that are that we've seen, but we've never seen it, so the question is not a valid question. So Eitzvei, the Gemara challenges with a braisa. So let's say the deformed fetus looks like an animal, or like a wild animal, or like a bird. And shulya imahem, and there is an afterbirth. So if there's connective tissue between the shulya and this deformed fetus, so then we're not worried about another vlad. So already now you could see the question is set, because we're not finished with the braisa. But the braisa over here is entertaining the idea that you can have a deformed fetus looking like a bird, connected to a shulya, and remember when Rebbe was asked this question, Rebbe dismissed it out of hand because it doesn't exist. And here in the Braisa, clearly the Braisa is entertaining such a possibility. Ain shulya, we're just finishing up the Braisa. Ain shulya kshuri mahem choshen levlad achir. Now, if there's no connective tissue between the birth and the afterbirth, so then we have to assume that the shulya is associated with another baby. Harini matal aleim chomish nevlados. And so therefore, we're going to have to be machmer, as if two babies came out. meaning the deformed one that we're looking at right now, and another one. And again, it goes back to the same points that we made earlier. And so therefore, what? Therefore, if the first one was identified as male, and the second one we don't know, because we don't know where it is, but we have to assume the worst, that it was a female. When I say the worst, I mean in the context of Tumah and Tahara. So we have to assume the worst, that it's a female. Therefore, the mother is going to be metame for not 7 days, but rather 14 days. Obviously, we're not saying for sure definitively that she gave birth to a female. We're not going to give the Yemei Tohar of the female, but again, same basic idea. Okay, so Shani Omer, sorry, this is still the continuation of the Braisa, top of Chav Zayin Amud Aleph, Shani Omer, Sheminimoch Shpir Shel Shel, Yevinimoch Shel Yeshel Shpir, Yevinimoch Shel Yeshel Shpir. Because look, here's what happened. We have one deformed baby. We have one afterbirth. And because there was no connective tissue, so we are going to say that they're not connected. And so therefore, where is the afterbirth of the deformed fetus? Disintegrated. Where is the birth of that afterbirth? Also, been there, but somewhat disintegrated. And therefore, we don't know where it is, but we have to now suspect that there were, in fact, two babies forming inside. Anyway, what comes out from this brisa clearly is that the deformed fetus can be looking like a bird, and there can be a afterbirth, and there can be connective tissue. So Tiyufta. So the Gemara says, okay. So the Gemara says, you're right. The seems to be a very clear refutation of Rebbe's dismissal when Rebbe said it never happened. It happened. At least the Braisa thinks so. Amar Rabba Bashila, Amar Rav Masna, Amar Shmuel, Maisa Vatalu Asashulia Bavlad, Ad Asara Yamim. Okay, in terms of connecting a birth and an afterbirth, there was a 10-day gap between them, and they could still be connected. Velo Amar Tolan Ela Bashulia Haba Achar Havlad. And but an important detail over here is sequence. It has to be sequentially birth followed by afterbirth. Now, even if there's a 10-day delay, that's fine. Now, remember, go back to what we learned at the beginning of Shir today. It has to be that it's a viable baby. If there was another baby after the viable baby, they would have come contiguously. But by virtue of the fact that it was the first one was a viable baby, and there was no other baby, and the afterbirth came, and even if it came 10 days later, they can still be connected. And the other detail is sequence. Birth followed by afterbirth. If you have afterbirth and birth, and even if they're back to back, now we no longer connect those dots, and we have to assume that that afterbirth was connected to another baby. Okay.
The connection is important because of Yemei Torah?
Again, this is going to be a nafka mina because, right. In other words, right. It's going to be a question of how many days she's going to have to sit for Yemei Tumah, and also in terms of when to start counting.
So if it's connected, then they start from the first one.
If they're connected, so then we could say that this birth and this afterbirth are one and the same, and there was only one birthing event.
Same number of days.
Right. So the Gemara now is going to tell tales of the bizarre, but in other words, but events that happen. So one event that happened is that there was a Shilya and Vlad that were born 23 days apart from one another. And by the way, reverse the order in which I presented, meaning it was first a birth and then an afterbirth, and 23 days separated from one another, and they said it was connected. Amale Rav Yosef Ad Chavdala Amar Lan. He says 23, you told us 24. Okay, so whether it be 23 or 24, obviously that's a long period of time, but again, the point is that as long as the first baby was viable and the baby was viable and the afterbirth came out at a later point in time, they are to be connected. Amar Rav Acha Bered Rav Avir, Amar Rav Yitzchak Maisa V'nishtah HaVlad Acha Chaver Lamed Gimel Yom. And now the Gemara is talking about 33 days of a lag between the two. So now the Amar Le Rav Yosef Lamed Al Amar Lan, and he says not 33 but rather 34. Okay, so we have now two stories that are told regarding the delay between the birth and the afterbirth. One is 23/24, okay, and the other is 33/34. Okay, now, can there be such a delay? Important correction. In the second story, it was not birth after birth, it was birth. Okay, that was just an important correction, right? The first one was birth. Right, Havlad Acher Chavero. There was 33 days or 34 days.
Two afterbirths.
No. Vlad Acher Chavero. Birth. Twins, right? That's what they call it also. So hani chalaman dama yoles latisha yoles lemakutayim mishkachala achen negmar tzrasa lesof shiva vachen negmar tzrasa letchilas tisha. Now, how can it be that there be a 33-day separation between one birth and another birth? Okay, now, in order to understand this Gemara over here, there are certain givens that we don't experience nowadays, but back in the time of the Gemara, they experienced. So we have to operate with the assumptions that they make. So I'm going to clearly articulate the assumptions. Gestation of a human baby can occur, and successful gestation, let me point it out, can occur in the following. It can either be that term will either be, full term is 9 months. Okay. It also can come out premature successfully, but only during the 7th month. The 8th month, back then, there was no successful baby that was born. If a fetus went through an eight month gestation period, that's a given. If the baby were to come out premature during the 7th month, so when during the 7th month, any time during the 7th month. It could be the beginning of the 7th month, the end of the 7th month, the middle of the 7th month. Okay. What if the baby went to term? A successfully gestated baby that went to term can come out. Now here it's a debate in the Gemara. Some are of the opinion that it can only come out at the end of the 9th month, and some are of the opinion that it can come out even in the beginning of the 9th month. Okay, so those are all the assumptions. I'll just quickly review. A baby can successfully be gestated 7 months in the mother. It doesn't matter when during the 7th month, beginning or end. 8th month, a viable baby cannot be delivered if it was gestated for 8 months. And during the 9th month, a debate in the Gemara whether it can come out only at the end of the 9th month or at any point during the 9th month. Those are the assumptions of the Gemara. And now with that in mind, so now the Gemara is trying to play the results of a lag between babies of 33 days. How could it be? Now,
beginning of the
9th and the end of the 7th. Oh, okay, fine. So you're already ahead. Now, if you subscribe to the viewpoint that a baby born in the 9th month can occur any time during the 9th month, so fine. So 33, 34 days is easily explainable, where you're going to have baby number one being born at the end of the 7th month and baby number two being born at the beginning of the 9th month. Good. That can easily explain now the 33-34 day gap. So the Gemara says, but if I say that a baby born during the 9th month successfully can only be born at the end of the 9th month, so then 33-34 is an impossible number. It's impossible. Because here's what you can say. You can say that the baby number one is born at the beginning of the 7th month and baby number two is born at the end of the 7th month. You could say that, sure. But that exceeds more than 33, 34 days.
That goes back to your
23. And then, right now we're just working with 33, 34. And then you could also say that a baby was born at the end of the 7th month, but then the other baby can only be born at the end of the 9th month, which is close to 60 days, yeah. Well beyond the 33, 34 days. So if I subscribe to this opinion that a baby can only be born at the end of the 9th month, so then I have no way of explaining this delay between baby number one and baby number two being 33, 34 days. And parenthetical note, it's not even so parenthetical, you know, where we started the Gemara this morning, Rav was of the opinion that when babies come out and they're viable babies, so there can't be a delay between one and the other. So obviously our Gemara over here is not in agreement with the Rav's position that was stated earlier this morning. Anyway. So Epuch Shmaitata, Lama Gimel Lashulya, Chav Gimel Levlad. So the Gemara says, okay, so what we'll have to do is we'll keep our numbers of either 23, 24 and 33, 34. And what we'll just simply do is we'll invert, meaning that the 23, 24 is explaining the twins that are born with a 23, 24 delay. Now that's, even if I say that ninth month is only at the end of the 9th month, but now we have within the 7th month to work, where baby number one could have been born towards the beginning of the 7th month, baby number two could be born at the end of the 7th month, and 23 days is perfect. If I went with the position, and the other number of 33, 34, that could be talking about the birth after birth. Okay. Amar Rav Avin bar Rav Ada, Amar Rav Menachem, Ish Kfar Sha'arim, V'Amar Lei Beis Sha'arim, Maisa V'Nishtav Vlad Acher, I'm sorry, Vlad Echad Acher Chaver, Gimel Chadashin. So I'm telling you a story that there was a delay between the twins being born of 3 months. And I'm not just telling a story. They're right here learning in the Beis Medrash. Meaning, see those twins over there? So I'm telling you a story. And the story is that one was born after the other 3 months. Right? Usually the question is, how many minutes were you born apart? Right? Is that what you ask twins? As if that information is going to be valuable. It's just, niceties. People ask. So over here, so how many months were you born apart from one another? And so 3 months. So Maninu, Yehuda v'chizkiah b'nei Rebbe Chiya, and the Gemara actually identifies. So the sons of Rebbe Chiya, twins, so they were born three months apart from one another. Wait, hold on a second. Now the Gemara says, wait 1 second. Can't be. In other words, in terms of the conception of twins, the Gemara understood, which we do as well, that the conception occurs at the same time. So it can't. So how could that be? So Amar Abayi Tipa Achas Haisav Nischalka. So the Gemara says that it was one seed divided into two. Again, the Gemara gives such a wonderful understanding of basic conception, and it divided into two. I understand that's true by identical twins, but the Shtaim Acha Nigmar Tzurasa B'Tikla Zayin V'Acha B'Sof Tes. And one was born at the beginning of the 7th month, which can produce a viable baby. That was brother number one. The other one came out at the end of the 9th month. That also could produce a viable baby. And there you have it. So we say 3 months, we mean nearly 3 months apart. But that's it. That's how you can have it. Now, nowadays, you're going to have to seek the annals of OBGYN history to see whether or not you can have such a delay in nowadays. Here's my best guess. Probably not. But nevertheless, though, at least within the realm of possibility, the Gemara considers it a possibility.
So these two that they are in the Beit Midrash, they were considered one bird?
What,
in terms of Yemei Torah.
Oh, in other words, how's a mother going to be treated regarding or Yemei Torah, Yemei Tara? So it's.
And what did their mother do, by the way?
Right. So we'll talk. Right.
Long time.
Right, we'll talk.
No, it's beyond 90 days. It's beyond the 66 days of the daughter too. I mean, they were boys, by the way. So it was only 33.
It was 7:33. Right, right.
7:33.
I'm not sure. Right now, I'll leave it like that.
Wait, was considered one birth or two birth? No.
Right. I'm with you. I don't know. Okay. It's a fair question. Okay. That is now puts a bookmark in the Gemara regarding the discussion of afterbirth. So Gemara's discussion regarding the birth and afterbirth in terms of connecting the two together. If they're connected together, so then we have a presentable explanation in terms of here's the baby, here's its afterbirth, and we don't have to be concerned about another baby. But if for various reasons, which we discussed over the course of yesterday and today's Gemara, if I can't connect the two, so that means then that afterbirth is going to be representative of another baby. And so there it creates halachic problems, which we've been discussing now for a day and a half. We're going to continue our discussion of afterbirth. But now we're going to talk about it in terms of Tumas Meis. Okay, our Mishnah, if you remember yesterday, the Mishnah going back to Chavav Amud Aleph, the Mishnah is in the middle of the Amud. And it discusses what happens when you find the afterbirth in the house. Okay, so the woman gave birth in the house and we don't know where the baby is. We just simply have no way of identifying where the baby is. But there's a clear afterbirth. And so with an afterbirth in the house, so do we say that there's Tumas Meis in the house? Or was there Tumas Meis in the house? So in the Mishnah, it was a machlokas between the Tana Kama and Rabbi Shimon. Tana Kama is of the opinion, Shulya Babais Abais Tamei, Lo Sheha Shulya Vlad, I'm just reviewing the Mishnah, El Shein Shulya below Vlad.
Yeah.
It, don't get confused. The afterbirth is not considered a baby, and it's not human remains, and it's not going to be Matamei Tumas Meis. It just happens to be that the afterbirth is reflective of the fact that there was a baby, and so therefore we have to assume that there was a baby here, there was human remains here in the house. Where is it right now? We don't know, but that can't dispute the reality that it must have been here. That's the opinion of the Tana Kama, and Rabbi Shimon says, no. Now, in terms of why, so if you remember yesterday, so I read Rashi, and I should have read Rashi yesterday. I did good by reading Rashi yesterday. But the Gemara is going to take some time in Rabbi Shimon developing the idea, which Rashi in yesterday's Mishnah said really succinctly, which is, of course there was a baby there, but the baby, in terms of what happened, it disintegrated in utero and basically got mixed in with all the other of the biological juices of the mother, and it came out with all the other blood of the mother, and bittul barov, it becomes nullified. That is Rabbi Shimon's explanation of what happened to the baby. Okay. And the Gemara will eventually get to that conclusion, Rabbi Shimon, It will just take the Gemara a couple of minutes to arrive at that conclusion. Shuli b'baisa b'istami tana rabbanan. The Gemara quotes a b'raisa. It's a Tosefta that basically speaks over this halacha with a little bit of dialogue. Shuli b'baisa b'istami losha ashuri vlad el shein shuli shein vladima divrei Rabbi Meir. Okay, so again, Rabbi Meir, which is the Tanakam of our Mishnah, says that look, there was a baby. It just happens to be that right now we don't know where it is, but the Shulya speaks to the reality that there was a baby there. Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Shimon, Matarim. So you have on the other side three Tanaim who say that they're Tahor. You know, in our Mishnah we only had one of them represented. But the truth of the matter is that there are three. Rabbi Yosef, together with Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon, all say they're Tahor. Amar lo Rabbi Meir. So they say to Rabbi Meir, it's Amodesh Shimotziah, but Seifel Abeis Kitzon, Shu Tahor. Now, let's say you were to take out this afterbirth with all of its other liquids that are there, right? In other words, it's an afterbirth together with other liquids that came out during childbirth. And let's say you removed it to another house. Question, they ask Rabbi Meir, are you prepared to tell me now that we're going to say that there's Tumas Mace in this pool of biological fluid? And Rabbi Meir says, Amalhem Ava. And he says to them, but. Now we know, we've seen this already a number of times in our own Masechta. The word aval, as it relates in a braisa, means I agree with you, but. Yes, you're right. Meaning, of course, this pool of biological liquid, which has in it the shilya and other liquids, if transported to another house, of course I agree with you. We're not going to say that there's tumas meis. I don't see the human remains there. So, valama, lefisheno. Because right now, the baby is not there. We don't see human remains. And so what we have over here seems to be checkmate. Meaning now they say to Reb Meir, oh, so this pool of biological liquid that's now moved from this house into another house. So you're telling me that the second house does not have human remains. Okay, so the first house also doesn't have human remains. So what's the difference? It is a really strong question they're asking Reb Meir. So his response is as follows. Look, when she discharged in the house, I'm calling it the primary house, just simply means the house in which she delivered. So when she discharged and delivered in the first house, so that means to say that there was some human remains there. And when it was moved from this house to another house, so we agitated it. And so therefore it disintegrated. But I'm telling you that in the primary house, there was some human remains there. That would be Reb Meir's argument, counter argument. Okay, so, yeah, so in the Braisa, one second. In the Braisa, so again, it's the same thing we learned in the Mishnah, just with a little more dialogue, a little more back and forth. And also, it's not just Rabbi Shimon, it's Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Huda, who are also of this position.
Why can't you say in the first case it's a Safek Tuma Rushut Hayachin? When you move out, it's Safek Tuma.
Right, but it's even less than a suffix according to Rabbi Shimon, because Rabbi Shimon will tell you that he has an explanation of what happened, meaning he really believes, not just me, he's not questioning, it's not a doubt, he really believes that this disintegration occurred in utero. Okay. Yasser Rapapa Achori de Rabbi Bikameh de Rav Hamnun of Yasser Bikameh my Taima de Rabbi Shimon. Okay, so now the Gemara is going to go over the reason behind Rabbi Shimon. So in your mind you already know it disintegrated in utero. It becomes batal. You know that already. Can I ask you to forget it for just a moment? Because the Gemara right now is going to consider other possibilities. And then the Gemara is going to come around full circle to give us the explanation of Bittul Baruf. But can I ask you please to forget for just a moment what you know? So my time with the Rabbi Shimon. Kasafa kol tumah shenisarav bo mimin acher batla. So the Gemara says, well, if I have tuma where I have some foreign matter that gets mixed in with it, it becomes batal. Now, the Gemara over here is not suggesting simple bittul, which is really going to ultimately be the explanation, but the Gemara over here is advancing an argument of foreign matter, even a little bit, that gets mixed in with the remains, is going to negate and counter the tumah of the human remains. Now, how? So, Amalu Rapapa, Hainu Nami Tamayu de Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi. So, now, Rapapa makes the following comment. You know, that's not only the explanation of Rabbi Shimon, that's also the explanation of Rabbi Yosef and Rabbi Yehuda. Now, if you think about it for just a moment, the statement of Rav Papa, it's pretty obvious. Meaning, we just saw the Braisa. So, the Braisa said, these are the opinions of Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Yosef, and Rabbi Yehuda. If we're giving an explanation for Rabbi Yehuda, sorry. If we're giving the explanation for Rabbi Shimon, So clearly, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi are founded on the same explanation. So Rav Papa now is making a statement, which quite frankly is obvious. Achichu aleha. In fact, it was so obvious that when he said it, so they mocked him a little bit in the base medrash. So Maishna Pshita, what difference would it be? Of course. Amra Papa afilu ki hamilsa leme inish velo nishtik. Kami Rabbe. So Rav Papa says, okay, so I said something that was a little too obvious. And I got ridiculed a little bit in the base medrash. It was worth it. Meaning when it comes to learning, so embarrass yourself. It's fine. It's totally fine to embarrass yourself. Meaning so you don't know something, so it's best to open your mouth and say something. I know when during the daf I often ask you not to say something, but I have to get through. It's only because I have to get through the daf. It's just that's the only reason why. But I really do appreciate the questions. I just got to cover. So anyway, so but in other words, but from the perspective of don't be embarrassed, ask a question. Right? There's no such thing as a stupid question, although it may have been a stupid question, but it still doesn't. You still have an obligation to ask. So no. So Mishum Shenamar, Im Navalta, I know the timing was great. Im Navalta Bisnase, Im Zamos Yad Lapeh. The Pasuk in Mishlei says that Im Navalta Bisnase, if you wear yourself down, if you make yourself somewhat degraded in front of others, not that's nivol, so Bihisnase, you're gonna be elevated. Meaning degrading yourself, embarrassing yourself by showing your ignorance. So not professing your ignorance, but trying to learn more, that's fine. And not only is it fine, you're gonna end up being elevated. But if you are arrogant and you're quiet because, oh, of course I knew that, and I don't need to open my mouth, so yad lepeh. Eventually, when they ask you a question, you're going to put your hand to your mouth because you're not going to know what to answer because you never asked. Okay. So now the Gemara is going to... Okay, so that was the little interlude, Musar of this morning in the daf. But now going back to the explanation, Rabbi Shimon. So right now, what do we have in front of us in terms of trying to explain Rabbi Shimon? Why is the afterbirth not going to be Tameh? So because there was human remains there, but it's mixed in with a little bit of foreign matter. The Gemara now challenges. I'm sorry, not challenges, sorry. V'az Rabbi Shimon Tameh D'tanya Melo Tavad Rekev Shenafel Atocha Alfer Kol Shehu Tameh Rabbi Shimon Metaher. So here we talk about a spoonful of human remains. Now this is Tarvad Rekev. Right, or let me read the full phrase, Melo Tarvad Rekev. Tarvad is a spoon, and Rekev is basically dust of human remains. Okay. Eventually what happens with bodies is decomposition, and eventually decomposition gets to the point where basically you're left with dust. I know the bones stay around for a long time. I tried doing a little bit of research in terms of how long bones do actually last. But anyway, bones do have good staying power, but in terms of the rest of the body, so there is decomposition, and it's reduced to ashes.
Like ashes from a cremation.
Oh, right, like ashes from a cremation. But over here, the Gemara is just talking about organic decomposition. Yeah. It just happens on its own. And so what's going to end up happening is that you're going to have these ash remains, and the halach is like this. If I have a full spoonful of these ashes, so then they're going to be tameh. If, however, it is mixed in with any foreign matter, and even just a little bit. So here we have a machlokus amongst the Tanayim in terms of whether or not it's going to be tamei tumas ol or not. Jeez. Now, it took me a while to wrap my head around this, if I can just share with you just my experiences in terms of understanding this better. Meaning, in terms of tumas meis, what do you need in terms of human remains? So you either need bones to give off tumas ohel. I'm speaking about full tumah of maga, masa, and ohel. So you either need bones, and even with bones, by the way, you need either the majority of the bones of the human, so or you're going to need its spine, its spinal column together with the skull, or you're going to need flesh of the human remains, the kazais of it. Outside of that, what else is going to give off tumas meis with tumas ohel? So we're learning together now the ashes. But even as we say the ashes, it has to be ashes that are unadulterated with any other material that are filling a full spoonful. So it's very specific. So obviously all this is halacha lemoshe misinai, and this is melo tarvad rekev. Okay, so melo tarvad rekev, the tying we learned on the brayso, melo tarvad rekev shenafel asocha afar kol shehu tamei. So if you have a little bit of dirt that falls in, So according to the Tanakhama, it's Tamei Rabbi Shimon Metaher, and Rabbi Shimon says it's Tzara. My time, the Rabbi Shimon. What's the basis for Rabbi Shimon? I'm a Rabbi Ashke Chasin al Rabban Debei Rav. The Asvei VeKamri Yavshe Shlo Yirbu Shtei Perei Ros Afer Al Prei Da Achre Shal Rekav VeChaser Lei. So as far as explaining Rabbi Shimon, they said, look, here's what's going to happen. If I have foreign matter, let's say dirt. So what am I going to have now in the spoon? Let's even say I have two particles of dirt. Between them, I have one particle of the ash of human remain. And so what do I have now? If I just looked at that, zoomed in on that. So I have now two and one. And I understand that I'm ignoring the rest of the spoon. I know that. But just trying to explain Rabbi Shimon, I have two and one. And so therefore, what does that create? Bittul. So now that one particle of human remain, ash, is now become nullified. And I no longer have the shear of the full spoonful. That's the Gemara says. That is an explanation, Rabbi Shimon. And to which the other Amarim say, I don't like that explanation. Just the opposite. If Shoshalo Yarbush, they pray to Srekev, I'll pray to Achas Afar. Lay. I'm sorry. Vinafish Lay Shiure. I could just. All I need to do is move the camera over just a little bit. And what do I have? In that one particle of dirt, I got ashes on both sides of it. And so therefore, I was mevatel the ash. I'm sorry, I was mevatel the dirt. And parenthetically, it sounds like from the Gemara, I was mevatel the dirt, and basically the dirt takes on the identity of the ash. Right? Which brings us really to a very fundamental question. When we say bittul, what happens to the item that's nullified? Is it just simply negated, or does it take on a new identity? The way the Gemara presents it over here, it sounds like the dirt takes on the identity of the ash. But okay, that's a wonderful shear in of itself. But in the meantime, Ella Amar Rabba Hayna Tamid the Rabbi Shimon Sofa Kitchlas Matchilas Nasalo Davar Acher Gangulin Asofa Nasalo Davar Acher Gangulin. So the Gemara now gives its preferred explanation, Rabbi Shimon. Why is it that when I have the spoonful of ashes of human remains, and I mix in just any amount of foreign matter, it no longer is a source of tuma? It's because we look at the way it initially becomes ash, and the way now it eventually becomes ash. And I'll explain it better in just a moment. Mahi, detanya. Ezu meshesh lo rekev, ezu meshesh lo rekev. So here now, this Tosefta is going to teach us that it's super specific in terms of how to create the human ash remains that it's going to be tummy tumas mace. And that is that the ashes have to be 100% unadulterated human remains. Once anything decomposes together with the human remains, you never get to this point of ashes that convey tumah.
It's less than the shear.
No. This has nothing to do with shear. This just has to do with the specific requirement of decomposition. There is a decomposition requirement.
Right. Isn't there a principle that if something has time that you have to decompose that animal, then it's negated and no longer time?
There's no principle. This is a halacha in of itself. It's its own unique halacha. So ve'ezu meshein lo rekev nikbar arum. So in order to get to this point, you have to be buried naked by arum shel shayish in a marble room or al gabi ritzpa shel avanim on stone floor zel meshesh lo rekev. Now, again, it took me a while to like really wrap my head around this. The Gemara is not condoning burial in this manner. In fact, the Gemara does not want somebody to be buried in this manner. The Torah wants us to bury in the earth. Okay? It just happens to be that if a person were to decompose in this manner, where it was nothing mixed in with the decomposited matter, the decomposited matter is only human remains. So then you'll get to this halacha of Melo Tarvid Rekev, which practically means, by the way, that you're almost never going to have this. If somebody's buried with clothing, which we do, or Aron Shel Eitz, which we do, or let's say even without clothing, without an Aron, but buried, decomposed over brick. And brick, we assume, is got a lot of dirt and dust. And so Zeu Meishein Lo Rekev. So this is not going to have a Rekev. And also, another detail is it has to be that the decomposition occurred after natural death. But let's say the person was killed, which means that some of the blood was sent elsewhere through the act of killing. So then also you're not going to get to the point of Rekev. So, just as a halacha of Rekev, So it takes a lot to get to that point in time. And the point of Rabbi Shimon now is as follows. So in terms of creating Rekev, so now we just learned together that the only way to create it is only by unadulterated human remains decomposing. So therefore, once you have Rekev, so therefore any time it's adulterated with any other material, it no longer is going to be a source of Tumah. That's the Svara of Rabbi Shimon. Gufa. Let's just spend a little bit more time with this. Tavad Rekev Shenafal Tocha Afer Kol Shehu Tamei Rabbi Shimon Matahir. So here, we're just going to review the Braisa, and the Gemara now wants to ask the following question. Melo Tavad Rekev Shenis Pazer Habayis Habayis Tamei Rabbi Shimon Matahir. If I have Melo Tavad Rekev where it's no longer in the spoon, but I spread it out through the house, so here Tanakama says the house is Tamei, Rabbi Shimon says it's Tahir. Utsricha, and the Gemara points out that I needed the first braisa that we learned together and the second braisa as well. Second, by the way, is not a braisa, it's a Mishnah. But we need both. So in the first braisa, the Chachamim say, look, that it is in accumulated in one area. But once it's no longer collected in a spoonful, but rather it's dispersed, it's distributed in the house, I might have thought that that the Chachamim would agree to Rabbi Shimon. Because you can't have it being a Tumas Ohel and then have it become a recycling the Tumas Ohel. And conversely, if all I had was the Mishnah Ohel that was describing the disbursement in the house, so I would have said, fine, over there, it's still unadulterated, but once I adulterated with a little bit, I might have thought that Rabbi Shimon would agree to the Chachamim Tzricha, therefore they're both needed. One more, Tanya Idach. Amalot Tarvat Va'od, Afar, Besa, Kvaros, Tamei, Rabbi Shimon Matahir. So, if let's say I have Amalot Tarvat, a spoonful of the human remains in ash form, and it's a little bit more than a spoonful, and together with some dirt in the Besa Kvaros, so it's Tamei, Rabbi Shimon Matahir, my Tamei de Rabban, Lefishi Afshar, Amalot Tarvat Va'od, Afar, Besa Kvaros, Sheimbo, Amalot Tarvat Rekev. So according to the Tanakama, look, even though it's got other foreign matter, but it's got a spoonful of the human remains. So, Hashad Amar Taima de Rabbi Shimon Mishum Sofa Tchilaso Gabi Shol Yamai. So the Gemara says, okay. So we just went through a lengthy discussion. I'm just setting ourselves up for tomorrow. We just went through a lengthy discussion understanding Rabbi Shimon's position when it comes to the spoonful of human decomposition. Rabbi Shimon says that once you adulterate it with a little bit of foreign matter, it's not going to be any more a source of tumah. Why? So the answer is because sofo kitchilaso. Just like when creating this decomposition from a tumah standpoint, it has to be unadulterated. So too, once created, it has to remain unadulterated. That's the svar behind Rabbi Shimon. Once we learn that, we now realize it has nothing to do with an afterbirth, meaning. And our discussion here in Nida, in the third parak, is that afterbirth that came out, according to Rabbi Shimon, we totally ignore the human remains. Why? Because it's adulterated with other matter? That's a halacha that's specific to Malot Tavad Rekev. That has to do with decomposition. Over here, it hasn't decomposed, meaning it certainly has liquefied, but it hasn't decomposed. So over here, when it comes to the fetus and the afterbirth, and we don't know where the fetus is right now, and it disintegrated and it mixed in, so because it has a little bit of foreign matter, that has nothing to do with our discussion. That is a discussion of ashes, but that's not part of our discussion. And so what we need now is a totally new svara to understand Rabbi Shimon over here. So that's where we leave ourselves off, and tomorrow we're going to start off with the svara behind Rabbi Shimon, which, if you haven't guessed already, it's because of Bittul Barov. But that's where we're headed tomorrow morning.